The views expressed on this podcast are those of the participants, not of Reuters News.
It's definitely a solid M&A environment. The number of deals is near all-time highs. The last 3 years, the number of deals has been up. I think why people feel that it's not so great is because the big deals haven't been as strong this past year or two.
That was Bill Anderson, the senior managing director at the investment bank Evercore, talking about the M&A market. He explains why he's feeling a little more confident about deal making after a couple of sluggish years. Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Jeff Goldfarb, global corporate finance editor at Reuters Breaking Views. I'm coming to you this week from New Orleans, where more than 1,000 lawyers, bankers, proxy advisors, and other merger mavens gathered for the annual Tulane Corporate Law Institute to talk about the latest trends in deal-making. While I was here, I caught up with Bill Anderson, a senior managing director at investment bank Evercore. Not only has Bill advised on more than $1 trillion worth of M&A over the course of his career, but he also runs Evercore's global business of defending companies against activist investors and hostile bidders. Bill and I discussed whether CEOs and buyout barons are ready to get back to doing deals following two consecutive years of declining activity. We also talked about the rise of pushy investors, the availability of financing, how the U.S. election might influence the thinking inside boardrooms, and much more. Give a listen.
So it's an interesting moment in M&A, Bill.
Yep.
You know, we're seeing a lot of mixed perspectives about where things are. How do you contextualize it in the span of what you've seen in your career? You've been through a lot of arcs. What does it feel like now in comparison?
It's definitely a solid M&A environment. The number of deals is near all-time highs. The last 3 years, the number of deals has been up. I think why people feel that it's not so great is because the big deals haven't been as strong this past year or two. Part of it is real concern about antitrust risk. Part of it is the financing markets just weren't available for PE deals. But, you know, we see enough this year already that strategic buyers are taking action, and private equity folks are starting to talk about deals. Private credit is helping out a little bit, too.
When did big deals become, like, sort of the metric? Like, I mean, because I feel like it didn't always use, everyone didn't used to be focused on, like, $10 billion and then $50 billion, but, like, when did that become sort of like the goalpost, I guess?
Well, people often evaluate deal volume by dollar volume, and that's always been a marker. I think for bankers, you know, having a steady stream of mid-cap deals has always been a very good thing. Larger deals are sexier, right? There's big names, and they catch more press eyes, so I think that's part of it, but you know, look, it's been a long time people have looked at deal volume from a dollar value as key.
Which is also a little bit misleading given because market values have gone up, mm-hmm. It's never inflation adjusted, and like it's always sort of raw on those things, but it's interesting.
And also you got to measure some of the private to private deals. The actual values, obviously if they pay cash, you get that, but there are a lot of those deals that are just not disclosed. And I think that's been certainly keeping things busy, even though that doesn't play into the dollar value. Because if you have two private buyers, they might want to disclose what the value was.
And that activity has been up quite a bit.
Quite a bit.
What does that mean for the market? Like, what is like either from a perception or like a reality, you know, metric?
It has two things. First, just starting from the basic M&A, there's just because the private equity players own so many assets. When they sell assets to each other, that's just become part of the market. The amount that they own is tremendous. For the near term, it's been a little trickier because the IPO exit for the sponsors isn't really there or hasn't been. Hopefully it's coming back. But the second thing is the financing markets were effectively shut for a good part of last year. Now they're back this year and private credit's helped that. Still expensive. So I think it's a matter of it's just a permanent part of the market. But it's not what it even should be, given the amount of assets being held, just because the financing markets haven't been great.
So you mentioned the cost of capital. Your rivals, peers at Morgan Stanley just put out a note titled "The Return of M&A." Mm-hmm. So what elements are there? You know, what elements are there to really believe that M&A is coming back, and what's still missing?
we had a very off year in terms of the dollar value of deals, and even the number of deals was down a little bit. You know, there are companies that come to their, you know, where the founders want to sell or get, you know, this almost like inventory that's pent up that wants to sell. They need to have a buyer, and they hadn't had private equity buyers because of financing and strategic buyers. So it's good. It's you've got all these folks who are wanting to sell. The value expectations are quite high because the market's high. But that's, some of those deals will happen, and I think that's why I'm a little optimistic.
I mean, some people are looking towards, like, rates starting to come down. Mm-hmm. How real? I've always sort of questioned, you know, whether it's, you know, if the rates mm-hmm. come down 25 basis mm-hmm. points, does that really, that doesn't really change the yeah. equation for a lot of people. I was under the impression that it was more about the stability. Like, we kind of knew that at last, you know, last summer, at the end of last summer, that rates were not going to be going up anymore, yeah. or at least you kind of felt pretty confident about that. Right. And that that would then bring buyers and sellers together because everyone could now, like, do the math. But that doesn't seem to, you're still talking about sort of buyers and sellers being on different pages.
Yeah. It's just, you'd expect if they were on the same page, we'd see even more deals. So as far as financing is concerned, there's three parts of financing. One is it available? And you had some banks who just couldn't loan last year, and that was a problem. You have the, as you said, the stability of rates so that you can figure out when you price your deals. And that's sort of coming back. That's a plus. The last piece, the cost of financing, you're right. If you get to the right price, you know, you're talking about a quarter basis point here or there, that's the least influential of the factors. But given how high the, if you're at least going to buy a public company, given how frothy some of the equity values have been, that cost is important if you want to clear a deal. Now, for divestitures and private-to-private deals, that's good. You have the stability, you have the availability, and you can factor out the cost. It's just harder doing on the public side.
I mean, you're probably, you know, one of the few people in the business that's actually done deals in a high rate environment before. What does it feel? I mean, how does that, do you remember it? Does this feel sort of similar? Is this a different, because we had so many years of low rates? Like, what's the...
Yeah, I think one of the key things, and I'm going to keep coming back, the stock market is so high that back, you know, 15, 20, 25 years ago, you can do a clearing deal because the market, you know, if you're an LBO buyer, you could take a loan and still make money. Now it's tougher, but not terrible. So it's, I think once you get your point at the beginning is the right one. Once you have availability and stability, the actual rates will impact some deals, or at least they'll be happening. And I do think, I don't know if it's a return of M&A yet, but it's going to be stronger.
One of the one of the things that everyone has a good chuckle about is that, you know, the dry powder numbers mm-hmm. that we all yeah. like to throw around because yeah. it's big numbers and a lot of money. But on the serious side, like, how much pressure is there now? Like, where would you rate it, mm-hmm. like, on a 1 to 10 or even just descriptively? The pressure that's right now, like, kind of building on private equity firms.
It's elevated, but I think it's almost as much for the exits too. They've held assets for a while and they want to monetize. IPOs weren't there and the buyer market wasn't as strong. That we see. As far as the pressure to spend, because maybe you have to return the money because it hasn't been used, maybe. I think the investors in the private equity firms don't want deals to happen just because you want to spend the money. And most of these firms would be very thoughtful about what they buy, but I think you're going to see more inventory. And so that's going to fill out, I think.
Yeah, so what happens to all those deals that were done, you know, at the tail end of the low rate kind of period? And exits are obviously very tough, but, like, are the return calculations now starting to change? And how is that all playing out?
Well, especially if you have to refinance that company. I mean, that's another story that's not really been focused on, is that you got a bunch of companies now that I think they're going to get squeezed a little bit, notwithstanding the stock prices going up, because when they have to refinance their loans at higher rates. And so if you wanted to use your own balance sheet, and if we're talking strategic buyers, it's going to be a little more costly. And at a time when you have to replace your current debt structure, you're going to have more costs, financing costs, because of repricing it now. Now, some of them may want to wait for a little while because they think rates will be better, but bottom line is financing is going to be more costly. So if you're a strategic buyer right now and you have cash and you don't have antitrust, you are looking pretty good right now.
I mean, we've seen a lot of cash and stock deals. Obviously, cash was, like, a huge thing towards the end of last year. I think the the volume of deals with cash and stock is pretty close to an all-time high.
Yeah.
As a percentage of total deal making. What is like? Is that smart? Is that like a kind of a? Obviously, it doesn't work for everybody. But.
You got to be careful. There is a component of stock. Some of them they couldn't. You know, the amount of cash you can have is financing limits and things like that. I'd say that with your stock so high for so many companies using it, not to say it's overinflated, but using that as a currency is fine. It's got to be careful because when you go out with these deals that have stock components, your shareholders will say, is that better than share repurchase, right? And so I think it's good. It's keeping some discipline on the amount of cash you use and if you have currency to deploy it. I think the trickier thing will be what are called mergers of equals and the stock for stock deals. I think you're going to start seeing some of them once people get comfortable with the regulatory, the straight deals. But I'm saying they should banish that term merger of equals because there's only usually one acquirer. And shareholders think when you say mergers of equal and talk about scale, you're not focusing on value. And so it's maybe social issues and things like that, which are important, those kind of deals. But I think because of relative valuations shifting is another reason why you haven't seen as much stock for stock, because at least one of the parties was going sideways. But if we get some stability, I think it's not just the cash deals. There'll be some more stock for stock deals, which, again, I'm not quite ready to see that's going to start with a landslide, but that's going to happen. Some conflict checks are already going in that direction.
Okay. We talked about a little bit about how the financing looks to be a little bit more stable. You kind of know where you are roughly.
Yeah.
One thing that has not been as stable is sort of the antitrust vibe. Although we've now had a couple years, it's gone from, the DOJ sort of throwing out the warning shot, and now they've followed through.
Yeah.
There's been some cases. Is there anything to distill from it though?
Complex on a whole bunch of fronts. So let's start with China. And if it has a China nexus, there's a real wild card of whether you can get that done. It's not just U.S. regulatory. The European regulatory has appeared a little tougher. Now, bankers and lawyers, I guess, talk about how antitrust impacts behavior. We're hearing it from the executives, right? And there's just no doubt that big tech deals have been a little harder to push or harder to get transact because of that's a real concern. It was funny when we went through the discussion about how second requests may have gone down, and maybe it's down as a percentage of overall deals because there's so many deals, but it just seems like every deal gets a second request, and it's like a whatever.
Second request meaning like from the regulators wanting to follow up.
Right, in the Hart-Scott-Rodino, our antitrust regime, you get a second request for information before they'll give you an answer about your deal going through, and that is costly. It can be up into double-digit millions of dollars to comply with, and that's another cost. And so, I think that is, for the bigger deals, it's the will my deal get blocked. For the smaller deals, it's the cost of the second request around that. Now, one other point that we made during discussion about antitrust generally, it's impacted how we talk about deals. And what I mean by that is if we have to finance a deal over 12, 18 months during regulatory, how do we make sure those lenders will still be there, right? How do we, when the seller's management team go in a different direction because they know they're going to be bought, how do you as a buyer make sure that the business stays stable during a longer period of time? So some standard merger agreement provisions like covenants and things like that, because there's a longer time from sign to close, that's another area of impact.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, you also spend a lot of your time defending companies against activists.
Mm-hmm.
That activity is really like where a lot of the action is right now.
Yeah.
What are you seeing like from a tactical point of view that has changed? What's happening in that arena?
Well, I think you're seeing much more in terms of the stealth accumulations through the broker dealers. So it was always part of it. Now it's become normalized. I think you're seeing, because there wasn't much in the way of financing, you saw more breakup. Where you don't need to have a buyer, more breakup pushes. So that's the case. You know, the interesting statistic in putting this together, I didn't realize it was this stark, is how little time nowadays there is between the campaign to settlement. And I think it's in part because the shareholders, the board and management team, talks to shareholders and get a sense of where things are and whether the fight would make sense. Now, you never hear about the quote-unquote success stories, but there were a couple in the last couple of weeks even where the client talked to five shareholders. The five shareholders told the activists, we're not, you know, they don't say how they're going to vote, but they're not supportive, and that pulls back. So there's a little bit more private ordering at the beginning. Now, activists often come in because a shareholder or two says, you know, we want change, we'd like you to come in. And I do think if the M&A markets come back, that push to force M&A because shareholders want it will be there. But the idea that you should always call for a public sale because the activist demands it, it's been a mixed bag. You've had some companies who haven't sold and the stock price falls precipitously.
Right.
You have a bunch of companies that have gone out with the process, and you know, then you have just arbs in your stock and dealing with that. And I'll tell you, it gives the buyers a lot of power, right? They know you're under pressure to sell. So, and it's often very public when buyers fall out, which is not great, again, from the sell side. I think the smarter activists know that that's a real issue, and if not, they know that that other shareholders are not keen to that. But that's another, in a really down M&A market, to say, go sell yourself, is a dicey proposition.
Right. Yeah, surprising. And what are the stealth accumulations like? What is that? Mm-hmm. What does that mean for you? Like, how do you coach companies on that? How does that change the game? I guess.
Yeah, we had a couple of stealth accumulations by strategic buyers too, to get an edge. You know, you buy the first round of shares at much lower than what you'll pay for the company, presumably. Stock watch is still important to know where things are going. Now, at some point, what do? If you see an accumulation, right? You just wring your hands. Well, it does give you a heads up that something may be happening, strategic or activist related.
Right.
Pills still work, right? You know, there was one judge said that they were going to hold some board liable for not putting a pill in if they were worried about their governance score or something. But yeah, there was one situation where the hostile bidder was accumulating, got up to like 8-9%. And it's clear that once the pill wasn't there, they would have kept coming and buying shares. And the thing is it's a weird, when you talk about pills to shareholders, you got some shareholders who get it, right? They've been around it. Some of them who are just religious against it. And some of it who may say, I don't care if the value of the company is 50. I'll take 30 because I came in at 15.
Right.
And so there's a real debate, and the thing on pills is they're net by definition short term because you can always replace the board and take the pill out. So the stealth accumulation is just part of it. The SEC rules have addressed some of it, but not all of it. So it's still available. And that situation a few weeks ago with the Children's Place wound up with 52% of their shareholders, 52% shareholder after 3 days of trading. And sometimes I get worried about when you have big blocks of shares, especially for strategic buyers, that the big shareholder sells it to the, and all of a sudden we have a 20% or 10% shareholder. That effectively happened when I was defending a company called CoreLogic, where they had a couple of their shareholders. And all of a sudden we woke up, we had a 10% shareholder in the activist bidder.
On the shareholder issue, one of the big changes in the markets, obviously, over the last 10 years, is this shift from active to passive.
Yes.
And how has that affected not just activism, but M&A and the whole area?
I'm going to say we as bankers, all the professionals, have to do much better in tailoring our deal messages to the different constituencies. And what I mean by that, when you go out as a buyer, you have certain shareholders who may be focused on share repurchase. You may have certain shareholders who are like governance focused. You got to at least think about with a full reg FD that you tailor to each. Companies engage with the index funds. If they haven't, they haven't gotten the memo on how important that is. It's a relationship building exercise. It's less about ESG, but it's more about building confidence with the index funds that this is the right board to make key decisions. Now, when I started big proxy fights, I remember with Bill Ackman at Target, where we were always worried the index funds slavishly would follow ISS, and when we'd call them, we would get Siri. No one answered the phone, right? Well, now they're the long-term shareholders often. They're the ones who've been, they own like 45, 50% of the stock. And, you know, they do look to research, I've found, as far as pricing, because they say you as a target, you say you're worth X, this is in hostile deals. The buyer will say, no, you're really worth Y. Sometimes they'll look to research, because not all the index funds have a lot of internal valuation expertise, but as practitioners, you got to figure out how to deal with that, right? And the good news is early on, much like you talk to your active holders, they're engaging more. And it's important because they are the long-term holders, and boards want to hear their voice on where they're going to go. Because you don't want to be surprised at the end of a fight, oh, my Heckman's, I lost these guys. Right. You should know that beforehand.
I mean, the other thing that's starting to happen, I don't know if it'll go anywhere, I'd be interested in your views, but like BlackRock and some of the other big funds are now trying to pass through the votes, right? Like they're trying to get the individual shareholders for any, you know, obviously they have their reasons for trying to do this. Does that change the equation? Probably not yet, but will it?
Yeah, look, I haven't seen it happening yet. And so it's just not... get overboard on that. But I would say if it diverts out, there's a chance that ISS is influencing those decisions. Like some of those parties may defer to ISS because the investors in the BlackRocks could be state pension funds and others. And because of that, look, BlackRock would take a position in a fight or a deal and have a learned view. If you parse out that vote to the other owner, that owner may be more straight ISS, which, you know, because ISS, you know, often can support activists or what have you. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think it may increase the influence of ISS if it happens writ large, but we'll see.
Obviously, one thing a lot of folks want to talk about and think about is the election, you know, as it affects antitrust, as it affects markets, valuations, all of it. I mean, are you thinking about it? Are your clients asking you about it? Yeah. Is it a real thing?
Well, clients can't help but talk about it. It's so interesting, I guess. But we were talking about this before the panel, a little bit during the panel, which is it does impact behavior as you get closer to the election. So if you think you're going to have a better regulatory outcome, you would maybe wait. I think, was it 4 years ago when it was looking like Trump was going to lose, some people tried to rush deals through because they thought the antitrust regulation is harsher. We're talking about it, but I think its real impact will happen closer to the election.
Okay. I mean, just to kind of wrap things up, what, you know, we obviously hear folks like you using the phrase cautiously optimistic all the time.
Yeah.
Is that where you are? Do you have a different, do you have a new phrase to give us about where the M&A market is?
Yeah, look, I mean, this, we've seen periods when it was great and bullish, and we've seen periods that are not so great. The momentum seems to be on the positive track. So just the, you know, the fact that the number of deals picked up and conflict checks, and if you look at the first 2 months of this year, it's almost double last year, although that last year was a tough year. I think the fact that you have a lot of PE firms who have, as I said, inventory to unleash, and corporates, you know, they're doing deals. And it was, even last year, it was not perfect, but they were doing deals and financing stable and all that. So a little more than cautiously optimistic, but it's still early on because all these conflict checks and early discussions have a long way to go to get the deals. So give me a call in 3 months.
More emphasis on the optimistic than on the cautious,
yes,
maybe?
Yes. There you go. Perfect discerning.
All right. Thanks very much, Bill. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for tuning in. This podcast was produced by Oliver Taslick in London. Subscribe to The Exchange and our sister podcast, The Views Room, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also read our views at breakingviews.com and on the X social media site, where our handle is @breakingviews. We'll catch up with you again soon on the next episode of The Exchange.
I'm Kim Vanell. Join me every morning for a roundup of what's happening at home and around the world. From the front line in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
To the heart of US politics.
When Trump said that he expected to be arrested, it seems like he was trying to get ahead of the story.
We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. For your essential daily briefing, follow Reuters World News wherever you get your podcasts.